Hello, happy that everyone was able to join us today, along with my colleagues, Dr. O and Dr. Dali. I'm Andrew Kirkendall from Moffitt Cancer Center, and we'll be talking about meeting highlights in myelofibrosis from the ASH annual meeting today. For myself, I'm assistant member professor at Moffitt Cancer Center in Tampa, Florida. Here are our disclosures. So briefly, just wanted to go over a program overview. We'll get a chance to discuss some of the recent developments that came out of the ASH meeting. Hopefully provide some context to those kind of emerging thoughts.
And we kind of separate things into maybe first line or second line therapy. Obviously, first line treatment when someone's just presenting, you know, what are you considering when coming up with what your treatment options are? And the first thing we've mentioned is that really there's nothing that replaces allogeneic hematopoietic stem cell transplant, as this represents the only curative approach we currently have for myelofibrosis. And so really this should be evaluated immediately in all patients to see whether or not they're a candidate. And again, this has to do with disease risk as well as patient-specific risk factors, but should be offered to any patient who is appropriate. Beyond that, when we think about first-line therapies, I think the simplest thing we think about is splitting people into kind of what are you trying to accomplish? And so these are not therapies that offer true complete remissions or partial remissions. They don't have great evidence for disease modification. So when we think about that, what we're really trying to do is improve patient-specific factors, disease-specific factors on a patient-by-patient basis. And so very roughly, patients can be divided into whether we're targeting splenomegaly or symptoms, or if we're targeting anemia. If we're targeting splenomegaly or constitutional symptoms, things like fevers, chills, night sweats, bone pain, weight loss, oftentimes we're thinking about some sort of JAK inhibitor-based therapy. This is stratified by whether or not patients have intact platelet counts, as many of our JAK inhibitors cause worsening of platelet counts. So in patients that do not have significant thrombocytopenia, we're often reaching for ruxolitinib, although we could also use fedratinib, which is approved as well with a line agnostic fashion. In patients that have more thrombocytopenia, specifically platelets less than 50,000, we have the accelerated approval of pacritinib for this patient population that we can use there, but also things such as dose-adjusted ruxolitinib, lower doses. Fedratinib certainly could be an option, especially in this kind of borderline platelet count of 50 to 100,000. And then maybe some combinations of ruxolitinib with danazol, ruxolitinib with thalidomide. These are things that have been tested in clinical trials and show some potential there. On the other hand, you have some patients, certainly a minority of patients, that may not have substantial splenomegaly or constitutional symptoms, and you may be targeting more anemia in this patient population. Again, we think about low platelets, and this can kind of stratify the treatment options we have. And patients that have no issues with their platelets, but certainly have anemia that needs treated, we can use things like danazol, lenalidomide, thalidomide, erythropoiesis-stimulating agents. And patients with thrombocytopenia, we often are reaching for some of these same options, but with the exclusion of maybe lenalidomide, which can worsen platelet counts. So we'll use things like danazol, thalidomide, or ESAs. But then oftentimes, we have an overlap with patients that have both anemia and splenomegaly or symptoms. And so there we're kind of grasping for combination therapies, often using ruxolitinib, but maybe using an agent that may support the red blood cell count or the platelet count at the same time. And then when we move to second line therapy, really we're thinking about the same agents, but we're really thinking about why we're moving to second line therapy. So in patients that have progressive spleen or symptoms, we're trying an alternative JAK inhibitor, maybe one that we can be dosed a little bit more aggressively and lower counts. In patients that have adverse events such as cytopenias, then we need to think about supporting those cytopenias, maybe using pacritinib that can be used in lower platelet counts or some of these anemia-based agents. And then certainly if we're having non-hematologic AEs, we might choose an alternative JAK inhibitor that may not have the same AE profile. I'll mention that for accelerated blast phase disease, we have very poor treatment options for this group of patients. We're often using hypomethylating agents, plus or minus JAK inhibitors if patients have some degree of splenomegaly, then rarely, but occasionally we're using intensive chemotherapy, hopefully as a bridge to allogeneic stem cell transplant. So when we think about areas of unmet need, I think there's certainly a few here. It's the treatment of cytopenias. We need more durable responses. We need to see true disease modification or eradication, remission, whatever you want to call it. We need to see the disease going away. We'd like to develop some non-JAK inhibitor approaches. Certainly, we have several JAK inhibitors that are approved, but we know there's more to the disease than that. And then, as I mentioned, accelerated blast phase disease remains an area of critically unmet need. When you think about emerging agents of interest, these are some agents that are currently in late phase clinical development. We have pacritinib, which actually has this accelerated approval for very low platelet counts, but also has an ongoing confirmatory phase 3 study that's in the works. Momelotinib has a positive results of a phase 3 study from the Momentum study, which we'll talk about, and certainly we're hoping for potential approval here in the next few months. Then we have pelabresib, which is a BET inhibitor, shown ability to synergize with JAK inhibitors, as is navitoclax, a BCL2-BCLX cell inhibitor. Parsaclisib is a PI3 kinase delta inhibitor, which is in development in the frontline setting in combination with JAK inhibitor, although the recent add-on study was just shut down for futility. Luspatercept is an anemia-based agent approved for MDS and thalassemias and is currently in late-stage development looking at the ability to help anemia with patients with myelofibrosis. Navtemadlin, an MDM2 inhibitor, has some potential for maybe disease modification. It's certainly acting on a biologically relevant pathway, so we'll have to see how it shakes out in the clinic. And then imetelstat, which is a telomerase inhibitor, also in late-stage phase 3 clinical trial being tested in the relapse refractory setting. So now I'll pass it over to Dr. O.
All right, thank you, Dr. Kuykendall. So it's my pleasure to share with you all some of the latest updates on JAK inhibitors. Okay, so we're going to start with one of the presentations from the ASH meeting last December, in which bone marrow biopsy analysis of fibrosis changes from the Simplify 1 study, in which patients with myelofibrosis were randomized to treatment with either momelotinib or ruxolitinib, were analyzed. So the background here is, of course, we know that bone marrow fibrosis in myelofibrosis is a key hallmark of the disease, and there have been several studies that have associated increasing bone marrow fibrosis with poor prognosis. Additionally, there has been some suggestion with some agents in development as to potential indication of disease modification as it relates to changes or improvement in bone marrow fibrosis. However, there's really limited data out there at the moment in terms of these particular associations. So the objective of this study was to look at the impact of two differentiated JAK2 inhibitors, momelotinib and ruxolitinib, in terms of bone marrow fibrosis changes, using the existing data from the completed Simplify 1 study to understand whether any changes in bone marrow fibrosis were correlated with clinical outcomes. So as many of you are probably aware, the Simplify 1 study, again, was patients with myelofibrosis randomized to either treatment with momelotinib or ruxolitinib. This was a total of over 400 patients with myelofibrosis who were JAK inhibitor naive. And there were over 300 patients for whom there were bone marrow biopsies collected pre-treatment and then after 24 weeks on treatment with either momelotinib or ruxolitinib. So this analysis was based on local grading of bone marrow fibrosis using the standard WHO scale of grade 0 to grade 3. And again, this is patients who are JAK inhibitor naive, and then looking at associations with clinical outcomes. So first, just as some baseline data. So in this study, over 50% of the patients in this study had grade 3 bone marrow fibrosis at baseline. You can see the pie chart here showing relatively similar distributions amongst the two groups. And then looking at the change in bone marrow fibrosis over time, this table sort of color codes in terms of those that had at least a one grade improvement or stable bone marrow fibrosis, or in fact worsening. And the take home point here is that they were very similar across the two groups. In both cases, approximately 21-22% of patients had at least a grade 1 improvement in bone marrow fibrosis. So again, in terms of patients treated with either momelotinib or ruxolitinib in this study, similar changes in bone marrow fibrosis were observed. Now, let's look at associations between these bone marrow fibrosis and changes and clinical outcomes. So here, looking at symptom response, essentially between the two groups, momelotinib and ruxolitinib, there were really no associations between bone marrow fibrosis changes, either worsening, stability, or improvement, and symptom response. So really no connection in terms of symptom response. And the same is true when looking at spleen response. So no association between specific changes in bone marrow fibrosis in either treatment group with regard to spleen response. And again, in terms of transfusion independence response, no association with changes in bone marrow fibrosis. Now, certainly from this analysis, as has been reported previously from this and other studies with momelotinib, there were a significant number of patients in the momelotinib treated arm that did achieve or maintain transfusion independence response, or TI response. So 78% of patients overall in the momelotinib group versus 53% of patients in ruxolitinib. And however, despite this distinction in TI response with momelotinib versus ruxolitinib, there was really no, again, connection to changes in bone marrow fibrosis. So that does suggest that potentially the achievement of TI response or anemia response with momelotinib may be sort of uncoupled or distinct or separate from changes in bone marrow fibrosis, and perhaps suggesting or hinting at the mechanisms by which anemia benefit is achieved, again, not being directly related to changes in bone marrow fibrosis. Here, we're looking at changes in bone marrow fibrosis in relation to changes in hemoglobin. So this is specifically looking at those that had worsening of bone marrow fibrosis. And what you can see in terms of the changes in hemoglobin is that there was improvement in the hemoglobin, generally speaking, with momelotinib treatment, despite a worsening of bone marrow fibrosis. Again, suggesting that this is not really directly correlated. Okay, and then also looking at those that had either improvement or stability of bone marrow fibrosis changes, so here looking specifically at improvement, you can see that whether it was grade 1, 2, or 3 improvement, again, the trend was that there was an increase in hemoglobin with momelotinib treatment, whereas there was a worsening of hemoglobin, generally speaking, with ruxolitinib. So again, not directly related to any changes in bone marrow fibrosis. And then lastly, there were no clear associations with overall survival in terms of bone marrow fibrosis changes in either group. So the conclusion of the study is that this study represents really the most extensive assessment of bone marrow fibrosis changes in patients with myelofibrosis to date. So more than 300 paired samples or biopsies from the patients in the study, and all of whom were JAK inhibitor naive at baseline. In both groups, there was about a 20% improvement, or 20% of patients had at least a grade 1 improvement in bone marrow fibrosis with 24 weeks of momelotinib ruxolitinib. This, of course, does not exclude the possibility that longer-term follow-up and analysis of bone marrow fibrosis changes could be relevant to efficacy outcomes, but at the least of this 24-week analysis, no association. And again, no specific association with symptom or spleen response, anemia improvement, or long-term overall survival. So this really suggests that this is not the relevant marker to look at least at 24 weeks, and maybe there are other analyses that would perhaps be more relevant. So now moving on to another abstract presented at ASH. This is focusing on pacitinib, and the highlight of this particular study is that pac償was demonstrated to have activity against ACVR1, which regulates production of hepcidin and therefore has relevance to potential anemia benefit with pacritinib in patients with myelofibrosis. Okay, so pacritinib and cytopenic myelofibrosis. So the approval indication is specifically for patients with myelofibrosis with a platelet count less than 50,000. So that is those specific patients with very severe thrombocytopenia for whom pacritinib is indicated. And it is able to administer to that patient population at the full approved dose of 200 milligrams twice daily. And previous analysis had shown, as shown on the right, that there was some degree of improvement in hemoglobin from the PERSIST-2 study, but really it hadn't been fully explored, and nor had the mechanism that might explain potential anemia benefit had been described. So that was the purpose of this study, was to investigates the mechanism by which pacritinib could lead to anemia improvement, and focusing on ACVR1 as a regulator of hepcidin production, which has been tied to anemia of inflammation in patients with myelofibrosis. The second aim of the study was to then look more closely at the impact of pacritinib on RBC transfusion independence from the phase 3 PERSIST-2 study data. So first, looking at activity against ACVR1 using in vitro kinase assays, this slide shows that when pacritinib was assayed for activity against ACVR1, actually was found to be a quite potent inhibitor of ACVR1. In fact, it was 4 times more potent than momelotinib, which had previously been shown to have activity against ACVR1. And this is distinct compared with fedratinib, which had very weak activity, and ruxolitinib, which essentially had no activity against ACVR1. Further, using exposure modeling and looking at the concentration of pacritinib that could be achieved in patients treated with this drug, it suggests that the concentration of pacritinib that could be administered or achieved in patients would exceed the IC50, essentially the level needed to inhibit ACVR1 fully, actually at all times in patients treated with this drug. Whereas similar analysis with momelotinib suggests that this effective concentration would only be achieved about 55% of the time. Now, ACVR1 as a regular hepcidin, looking downstream of this to confirm its effects, it was demonstrated that pacritinib could inhibit downstream SMAD signaling as shown on the left. And then on the right, looking specifically at production of hepcidin, confirming that pacritinib in fact does potently inhibit production of hepcidin in liver cells. Okay, so now turning to the clinical data to substantiate that this translates to an anemia benefit with paconidib. This is from the PERSIST-2 study and focusing on patients who were not transfusion independent at baseline and who were randomized at least 12 weeks prior to study termination, and asking which percentage of these patients became TIA or transfusion independent on study through week 24. In terms of the baseline characteristics, but note that in the BAT arm, a good chunk of the patients, 42% of patients, were treated with ruxolitinib. So in comparing the two groups, those treated with 200 milligrams BID, the approved dose of pacritinib, versus those in the BAT arm, you can see here the TI conversion rate, 37% versus 7%, so certainly better in the arm of patients treated with pacritinib. Also noting that patients in the BAT arm were allowed to receive erythroid support agents, and despite this, there still was a clearly superior benefit in terms of TI response with pacritinib treatment. And using more stringent criteria as well, a similar analysis or similar difference was observed in terms of pacritinib versus BAT, and in both cases, this was true regardless of JAK2 allele burden. And then looking at reduction in transfusion burden, at least a 50% reduction in transfusion burden, also clearly superior with pacritinib versus BAT. Taking it all together suggests that the pacritinib may achieve anemia benefit in patients with myelofibrosis through its sustained inhibition of ACVR1 activity. And knowing that its other targets include JAK2 and IRAK1, that these targets together may relate to inhibition of inflammatory cytokine production and then translated in terms of reduction in hepcidin production and therefore leading to amelioration of anemia in patients with myelofibrosis. So I think I covered the conclusions, but just to highlight some of the key points here. So this study demonstrates that pacritinib is in fact a potent ACVR1 inhibitor and that it can reduce hepcidin levels in vitro and that this therefore potentially translates to achievement of transfusion independence in patients with myelofibrosis treated with pacritinib. Okay, so finally to wrap up my section, just briefly touch on updates from the MOMENTUM phase 3 study of momelotinib versus danazol in patients with myelofibrosis previously treated with a JAK inhibitor. Okay, so this is just a schematic showing that momelotinib targets both JAK2 as well as ACVR1, and these three targets together are thought to lead to momelotinib's capacity to address the sort of three of the cardinal hallmarks of MF, including symptoms, spleen, and anemia. So the MOMENTUM study is an ongoing phase 3 study of momelotinib versus danazol in symptomatic anemia or anemic JAK inhibitor experienced patients. You can see the study schema outlined below. And as presented at ASH, these are updated results from the MOMENTUM study, but here we're focusing on the top line results at week 24. And in fact, all of the primary and key secondary endpoints were met, including symptom response as shown here on the left of the top part of the slide, superior for momelotinib versus danazol. TR response was assessed in terms of non-inferiority, and momelotinib did meet this in terms of 30.8% TI response versus 20% with danazol. And a spleen volume response, momelotinib clearly superior to danazol. So again, momelotinib did meet all of the pre-specified primary and secondary endpoints, and the efficacy was maintained in patients with thrombocytopenia as shown in the below, consistent with the overall intention to treat patient population. Okay, so and then just the reported conclusions from this analysis. So again, momelotinib inhibits JAK1, JAK2, and ACVR1, and so these three targets together are thought to provide a benefit in terms of symptoms, spleen, and anemia. Again, all of the pre-specified primary and key secondary endpoints were met, and this includes significant improvements in symptoms, spleen, and anemia measures with momelotinib versus danazol. Overall favorable safety as well and trend towards improved overall survival were reported, and together these findings support potential future use of momelotinib as an effective agent for MF patients, in particular those with anemia. So now, as I covered in the prior presentation with pacritinib, now known to have activity against ACVR1, so both of these drugs share some capacity to do so. Momelotinib is a little bit distinct from pacritinib in terms of both JAK1 and JAK2. So here with momelotinib, JAK1, JAK2 plus ACVR1. Okay, so I'm going to hand it over to Dr. Ali to take the next section.
Thank you, Dr. Hall. It would be a good time to go on the updates on the combination with the JAK inhibitor and other agents after Dr. O has talked about the updates on the JAK inhibitor updates for MPN. So the current treatment is, we have JAK inhibitors, that remains the mainstay of treatment since their approval in 2011, so for last 10 plus years. And they are effective initially, but the durability of responses are only seen in few patients, and eventually most of the patients, they actually progress at some point on the treatment. Therefore, we need a treatment that will be able to have better responses and longer-term responses. These are the current JAK inhibitors that we have, ruxolitinib, fedratinib, pacritinib, and momelotinib, as Dr. Oh talked about with this updated results, and hopefully we'll get approved later this year. And as you can see that patients, the primary endpoint for most of these studies was spleen volume reduction, and about 30 to 40% of the patients actually do respond. They get spleen reduction, and the targets are for ruxolitinib is inhibits JAK1, JAK2, fedratinib, JAK2, pacritinib, JAK2, and ACVR1. And ruxolitinib is currently approved for intermediate high-risk myelofibrosis, fedratinib for similarly intermediate high-risk in first-line and second-line setting. And pacritinib is approved mainly for as a first-line for patients with platelet count less than 50,000, and as a second-line for patients with the high-risk intermediate who are either progressing on the other JAK inhibitor. So the goal of the combination with JAK inhibitor for some of the other agents to get faster disease control and to use these medications which have non-overlapping toxicities, so they are more tolerable, and to mainly have a durable response, the patient are able to benefit from it for a longer period of time, so and it can delay the progression and hopefully delay the progression to end-stage myelofibrosis and AML, and eventually actually disease modification where there's some changes in the bone marrow fibrosis or allele frequency reduction. We're going to go over three combinations and three abstracts that were presented in ASH 2022. Basically, the first one, add-on parsaclisib to ruxolitinib therapy in myelofibrosis with suboptimal response to ruxolitinib, the final result from the phase 2 study. Second, venetoclax and ruxolitinib in JAK inhibitor-naive patients with myelofibrosis. And third, pelabresib combined with ruxolitinib for JAK inhibitor treatment naive patients with myelofibrosis. I'll just add on, like Dr. Kindal mentioned, that the study of add-on parsaclisib for patients with suboptimal response to ruxolitinib was terminated due to futility, but this is actually included in this presentation. So there's two different approaches for combination. There's an approach to add-on where someone is having a suboptimal response and an agent is added to improve the responses, combining with the JAK inhibitor, which in this setting is ruxolitinib. So there was a study done that was presented last year, which was adding on navitoclax to patients who have suboptimal response to ruxolitinib or have progressive disease. So this study included about 34 patients, and the doses were 50 milligrams to 300 milligrams. And what they saw, the primary endpoint, which was a spleen volume reduction, 35% or more, was about 26% at 24 weeks. At any time point, was 41%. And secondary endpoint, which was the 50% total symptom score improvement, was about 30%. They also noticed that there was a 64% improvement in the hemoglobin, and about they noticed that one-third of the patient benefited by improvement in the fibrosis on the follow-up bone marrow biopsy. And generally, it was safe, and there was some thrombocytopenia, but otherwise, it was safe in the setting. Similar as an add-on setting, pelabresib, which is a BET inhibitor, was tried, and similarly, in add-on setting, when they look at the primary endpoint, which is a spleen volume reduction at 35% at week 34, was about 20%, and it was 17% transfusion dependent, and about 26% in the non-transfusion dependent population. Whereas the SVR 35 at any time was 30%. If you look at the total symptoms improvement, 50% or more at 24 weeks was about 37%, and it was seen in both transfusion dependent and non-transfusion dependent setting. So now we'll go over the results for the addition combining JAK inhibitor and in JAK in naive patients. So this was the arm 3 on the study, and the primary endpoint was spleen volume reduction 35% or more, or a key secondary endpoint was the total symptoms score improvement of 50% at 24 weeks. And these were the results. As you can see, the spleen volume reduction at week 24, 35% or more volume reduction was 68% in the JAK naive setting when the two agents were combined, and the total symptom score improvement was about 56%. you can, if you remember that in the add-on setting, it was about 20% and 30%. So definitely when as the upfront addition, you see much better responses as in the combination setting. As a supplement to this, they looked at biomarker analysis to try to really understand that what's really happening in these patients just beyond the spleen volume reduction and symptoms improvement. Because we have been using these endpoints for since the COMFORT studies, but to get more understanding about the biological changes that are developing in patients who are getting these treatments. So they look at the JAK2 variant allele frequency reduction. They also look at the bone marrow morphology, looking at the improvement changes in the fibrosis and the megakaryocytic morphology, and also looked at the plasma cytokines. 27% of the patients had actually bone marrow fibrosis improvement. And if you see on the right side, you also see improvement in the variant allele frequency in majority of the patients, 20% or more. And similarly, and this correlates well with the hemoglobin improvement as well as the bone marrow fibrosis grade improvement. Looking at the morphology of the bone marrow, what they noticed was that there was a declustering of megakaryocyte. You know, a characteristic feature is atypical megakaryocyte in the cluster formation in MPN, especially in myelofibrosis. So what they noticed that the distance between the megakaryocyte was actually increased in patients who were on treatment. And this is shown also on the panel on the right side, that the distance actually is increasing on the patient who are on the treatment at 24, 36, and 48 weeks. Third, they look at the changes in the cytokines, and they notice a patient who were having a responsive with spleen volume reduction, there was a significant improvement in the cytokine reduction. They look at multiple different cytokines. They are listed on the right panel, beta 2 microglobulin, TNF receptor 2, TNF alpha, VCAM1, VEGF alpha, and 1 beta. And you can see in the curves here, in the patients who are having spleen volume reduction, there was in the arm 3, these are the blue dots. There's a reduction in the inflammatory cytokines. Next, we'll talk about the REFINE study, which is a phase 2 study combining navitoclax with sunitinib in JAK inhibitor naive patients. And here, patients were given 200 milligram daily starting dose along with the ruxolitinib. And the primary endpoint was spleen volume reduction, 35% from baseline at week 24, as assessed by MRI or CT scan. Key secondary endpoints was the changes in the bone marrow fibrosis and reduction in the variant allele frequency. And the results showed that there was a very good reduction in the spleen volume, 35% more. Here you can see in the primary and secondary, about 59-67% patients had a spleen volume reduction. Here it's kind of divided by age, DIPS, and HMR, and all of them actually had good improvement in the spleen volume at week 24. On the right panel, you see a reduction, changes in the bone marrow fibrosis, and the green color is actually for patients who had bone marrow fibrosis reduction. So about one third of the patient had a bone marrow fibrosis reduction on treatment. Two of these patients actually had a CR where the fibrosis completely resolved on treatment in these patients. And they also look at a reduction in the JAK variant allele frequency, and 20% or more was noticed in the JAK2 and KLR arm. The majority of them, as you can see, was JAK2, but there was actually a reduction in the variant allele frequency, 20% or more at week 12. So lastly, we'll talk about the add-on parsaclisib, PI3 kinase delta inhibitor, and this was the study that was presented. Again, this study has been discontinued due to futility. So here they had two different dosing schema. They had a patient on a daily weekly dosing where patient received 8 weeks of treatment with 10 milligram or 20 milligram of parsaclisib along with ruxolitinib, but after that was transitioned to either 10 milligram or 20 milligram every week dose versus a daily dose of 5 or 20 milligram, which with a continuation of 5 milligram daily dose after 8 weeks. And here the results on the left side, you see 12 weeks, and on the right side, 24 weeks results. So basically, it showed that all daily dosing had much better responses compared to daily weekly dosing. For example, at the week, 35% more volume reduction was not seen at 12 weeks. in daily, weekly dosing, whereas it was seen in about 2 patients or 4%. And if by 24 weeks, it was seen only 1 patient in daily, weekly dosing versus 3 patients. And if you look at 25% volume reduction, it was actually much better as well in the all daily dosing arm. And looking at the symptom reduction at 12 versus 24 weeks, similarly, I mean, there was improved responses in the all daily dosing arm, 20% versus 30% in 12 weeks, and actually number of patients. And similarly, if you look at 24 weeks, it was 27 versus 37 patients that had responded. And they looked at spleen length and the symptom score by dosing group. And the green is all daily dosing, prosaclisib dose, whereas the blue is the daily weekly dosing. And you can see that there was a progressive response in the spleen length reduction in the all daily compared to daily weekly dosing, and similarly with the MPN symptoms score improvement. I'll hand it over to Dr. Kukendall to go over the updates on future directions in MPN therapy.
So the one last presentation we wanted to take a chance to discuss was actually part of the plenary session at ASH this past year, and really focused on INCA 033989. So you know it's not very far along. This is actually a monoclonal antibody that has activity against CALR. And so this is really something we wanted to touch on, not because this is something that's coming into the clinic in the next year or so, but something that really kind of represents a shift in how we may think about treating these diseases. And so this is a fully human IgG1 selective antibody that really is selected for the mutant form of CALR and inhibits mutant CALR-dependent TPO receptor dimerization. This does not exhibit function against BAF3 cells that do not express mutant CALR, and this also shows some synergism between this antibody and ruxolitinib. You know, importantly, what it did is it showed the ability to selectively target CALR-mutated hematopoietic stem cells while preserving proliferation and differentiation of wild-type counterparts. And so this is something that could potentially be selective to the disease and really kind of promote in the onset of an era where we are really targeting these diseases in a more mutation-specific fashion. You know, something we won't mention is there was also the development of a biological model that showed that if we were able to do the same thing and target the mutation-specific JAK2 mutation, we would also be able to see kind of eradication of these JAK2 mutant hematopoietic stem cells. And so while we've talked about a lot of different agents that may be able to help with splenomegaly or constitutional symptoms, or even cytopenias, and may potentially bring some evidence of disease modification when we use combination therapies, there is this kind of promise in the future that we're going to be able to use agents that really target these driver mutations that ultimately drive the disease. So that brings us to kind of going back to the initial slide we presented that talked about the future of myelofibrosis treatment. And what I'd say is that this is kind of what a hypothetical future may look like. And this certainly doesn't call into or integrate the potential of things like a monoclonal antibody against CALR, but just talks about the agents we briefly discussed. And in the light blue, you can see what was existing in the first slide we presented of our current treatment algorithm. But in the dark blue, you can kind of see how things may change. And I think without going through each of these specifically, what you can see is that we're going to start to have more options for various different phenotypes of myelofibrosis patients. You're going to have more options for those with thrombocytopenia, more options for those with combination of anemia and splenomegaly symptoms, and certainly more options with patients that have anemia. And so I think we may not be showing true disease modification yet, but what we are doing is able to bring multiple different options of therapies for patients with myelofibrosis. And then we look at second line therapies. Again, what we see in the navy blue is more options for patients who progress in terms of splenomegaly and symptoms, and those patients who have cytopenias associated with their initial therapy. But also this highlights where we're lacking. Again, we're not seeing any new promising options for accelerated blast phase disease. This remains an area that we really need to do better. Patients with accelerated blast phase disease have a terrible prognosis, and we need to bring more options for them to the table. We really need to understand some of these non-hematologic AEs and figure out if all JAK inhibitors have the same risks or if these are specific to certain JAK inhibitors. So with that, what I do want to do on this discussion slide is certainly hopefully bring Dr. Ali and Dr. O and really get maybe a 1 or 2 minute synopsis from each of you guys on where do you see kind of the changes we saw at, from ASH? And I'll start with Dr. Oh, but the changes we saw with from ASH looking at these novel therapies, you presented on predominantly JAK inhibitor therapies. Where do you see the field going and how do things change based on what you saw and frankly what you presented this year at ASH?
Yeah, thanks, Dr. Kirkendall. So, you know, I obviously highlighted updates related to, in particular, pacritinib and momelotinib. And I do think that in terms of JAK inhibitors, at least, that is where there's going to be, you know, further evolution and change coming very soon. Of course, we're in particular expecting that momelotinib may be approved officially as early as this summer. And so, you know, if that becomes an available agent, we will then have four JAK inhibitors approved in different settings for patients with myelofibrosis. And I think more broadly, you know, with momelotinib potentially being approved and with the recognition that pacritinib has some capacity to potentially improve anemia in part related to targeting ACVR1, you know, this expands our repertoire with the application of our JAK inhibitors, not just for spleen and symptoms, but potentially with at least those two JAK inhibitors, the potential or prospect of addressing anemia.
Yeah, fantastic. Couldn't agree more. I'll pass it off to Dr. Ali. What excites you the most about the different combinations that you presented?
So I think the two combinations, navitoclax with ruxolitinib and divarasib ruxolitinib, really built on the responses that we saw, for example, in the COMFORT 1 and 2 studies. The responses were about like high 30s and 40% for spleen volume reduction. We are seeing much higher in the approaching close to 70%. So definitely getting a deeper response in terms of spleen volume reduction and symptoms improvement. And also looking more at some changes in the biology of a disease, for example, variant allele frequent reduction. Changes in the bone marrow fibrosis, we don't know exactly how that might really translate into long-term outcomes. But going more into those areas of disease modification, I think is interesting with this new combination and the deeper responses.
Thank you so much again for joining us. Thank you so much, Dr. O, Dr. Ali, for participating in this, and I hope everyone has a great day.